Hello.
It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 98th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. My most recent pieces for the Westchester Guardian are at website www.westchesterguardian.com. They include the 171st column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find the links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. Try the newspaper, subscribe. There's only one email per day, and I curate articles from all over the Western world. The list of upcoming shows is also at my site. My guest next week, August 2nd, is attorney and stalwart of the Narrowbacks, Edward Fitzgerald. As I mentioned, this is the 98th show in the series, and the 100th episode on August 9th, I will have the number of previous guests at the microphones to fill us in on the most recent exploits. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. Then my guest tonight is writer-producer Bonnie McBird, author of, among other things, the much-praised Tron, which is how I first knew of her. I first met her in person a few years later when I moderated the Macworld panel in Boston, at which she appeared, and I was dazzled by her energy and professionalism. More on that later. Since then, she's won Emmys for documentaries, acted, run a production company. When I first met her, she was providing video support for Apple CEO John Sculley, taught writing, and is the author of the forthcoming novel, All in the Blood. So we obviously have a lot to discuss tonight. Let's get right to it. Good evening, Bonnie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I went to a little a school there called Bury. It was a little elementary school, and I had a very good time as a child.
During your early years, you were involved in writing, art, and music, and you were a child performer then, too. Also, tell us about those years.
Sure. I was really lucky. I was very interested in all the arts, as most little kids are. You know, most kids draw and paint and sing and dance, and they do that without, you know, any worry about how good they are. And I was very lucky to have a very artistic mom, and she was an artist herself. And there was a cabinet in our kitchen that was kept locked, and in it were these fantastic things. It was full of art supplies. So my childhood was, you know, a very exciting time full of magical creative work with my mom encouraging me. And also in school I did plays and played music and so forth. And I had a very, very exciting time creatively as a kid.
Do you remember if any of these activities shaped your earliest aspirations? Did you want to be an actress or a writer or an artist?
Yeah, I think a lot of creative kids, I think, I didn't formulate exactly. I sort of wanted to do everything, and I like to write, so I wrote plays for my cousins and me to perform. I enjoyed pretending and dressing up and had all kinds of costumes, and, you know, I had a special friend, and she and I had an entire world we created, a fantasy world, and all these characters that we populated, and I liked to draw them as well and write little sketches for them. And then when I was, I guess in maybe third and fourth grade, I was in the San Francisco Children's Opera, and I sang on stage in a group of small children, and then I continued doing that pretty much all the way through school.
I couldn't draw very well, but I cut out characters from the Sunday comics with my hands, and then I made stories about them. So I actually paste them into books and that.
You mean like cartoon characters?
Yeah. Oh, like Alley Oop and Captain America and people like that.
Yeah.
And then high school, were you active in plays, newspapers, et cetera, through the years of high school?
Yes, I was. I enjoyed creative writing in the English classes very much. And I did drama all through high school. I went to a high school, El Camino High, in South San Francisco, that was very, very oriented toward the performing arts. It wasn't an official performing arts school. It just had a very strong program. And so we had a stage band there that used to win the 4 Western States stage band competitions every year. And they played seriously great American standards and jazz and so forth. They were fantastic. And this same group would play live for a musical every year. So we had a play and a musical every year. So from the time I was a freshman to the time I was a senior in high school, I was extremely active in the theater. And at that point, that's when I sort of decided that's what I really wanted to do, was something to do with performance.
You also became active with computers in your high school years, and you won the Mathematics Award. Did you see an integration with your arts interest at that time?
That's a really interesting question, John. That's actually my computer experience started before high school, weirdly enough. And considering how old I am, which I won't say I'm on the air here, but it was a long time ago. And in junior high, I took part in a program that Patrick Soupy's ran, which was a program in the elementary and junior high schools where they taught very rudimentary programming to children, but they did it just on paper. We weren't programming any machines or anything, but it was basically like little logic games, little logic puzzles on paper, and I got very excited. I really liked those, and I kind of connect the thrill of doing that stuff with the same feeling I get now writing a mystery, because it's a similar feeling of solving a puzzle, and then you get this aesthetic pleasure out of when it falls all into place. So, yeah, there is kind of a weird emotional connection there. So it started, as I said, a lot earlier. Then in high school, I didn't really love math, but I did very well in it. And, it wasn't something that attracted me to go into as a career or pursue further, but I just... But again, like the programming, it's one of those things that there's an aesthetic component to it, and I felt that. So I did actually kind of enjoy it.
The funny thing, and I'm not dating ages too much, but my wife, who's a tad younger than I am, went to public school in Philadelphia, and it was supposedly the first high school in the country to bring computer courses in, and similar to you, they didn't have a computer there, but she worked on a theoretical machine at the University of Pennsylvania, and she was a math major. I, on the other hand, was an English major who didn't know or care about computers until I very luckily got into a program with the federal government, and when I was asked what I wanted to do, I said I wanted to do that because the smartest people I'd met there were in a computer area, and 50 years later, it worked out, I guess.
Right.
And then college. Where and what was your major?
Well, I went to Stanford, and as an undergrad, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. They didn't have a very strong drama department. It was part of the English department at that time, and it didn't appeal to me because I really had sort of wanted to go to Broadway and be on musicals or something. I had that in my head, and that wasn't really what was there. But, I'd also put a lot of energy into excelling academically, and I felt, you know, strongly that I really needed to take advantage of being at this incredible university. And so, but as a freshman, I had no clue what I wanted to do. I was so interested in so many things. And I randomly declared a music major because I was playing classical guitar and singing, and I could get those music lessons for half price if I was declared as a music major. So just kind of, you know, as a matter of, economics, I just declared a music major. Then I ended up staying as a music major. But around junior year, I had finished all of my requirements for music, and I realized that I didn't feel I had the talent to make it as a musician, and I wasn't really interested in teaching music as a career. So I suddenly thought to myself, oh, no, what have I done? You know, I've wasted these precious years here. I've got this major finished, and I don't really want to do this. Now what? And I took a course in filmmaking, and, you know, like 1 week into the course, I was suddenly knew that this is what I needed to do. This was my field. And the reason for that was because filmmaking is the art form that encompasses all of the arts. And you can pour so much of yourself, so many of your talents into the meta art form that is filmmaking. And it just intrigued me, and it was so empowering and so fun and so fascinating, and I just suddenly realized I wanted to make films. And all my acting training and all my visual arts and my music, everything could go into this. And I loved writing. I loved telling stories. All of this could go into filmmaking. I do have one other thing that happened in college that was kind of interesting, and that is that I've always been, as I mentioned, attracted to math and computers. And in college, you had to, at that time at Stanford, you had to have certain you had a certain requirement for math science that you had to fulfill, the breadth requirements. And I took one math class, and I didn't care for it much. And so I signed up for computer programming, computer science. And you're going to laugh at this, but computer science 101, like the beginning class, was taught by Donald Knuth.
Okay.
And so, you know, he's this fairly famous guy. And, of course, he just lectured, you know, to a hall full of, you know, a couple hundred people. And then we broke out into little groups and really worked with our TAs. But we got to program, and we were programming on a PDP-11. So those were the days of punch cards. And I'm sure you remember those days too, right?
I certainly do.
Right. Yeah. So those were. So what I did is I learned basic programming, and I really, really enjoyed that class, and I did quite well in it. And I remember spending many a late night over it was Polia Hall, it was called, I can't remember, where the PDP-11 was housed. You know, it had to be kept cold. And it was batch processing because the computer couldn't handle everybody's stuff at once, so you had to do it, you know, in order of importance. And, you know, as beginning students, we were way down on the totem pole, so our stuff was run in the middle of the night. And so we would go over there in the middle of the night with our little stacks of cards, and, you know, you sure didn't want to drop those because your programming would just take you an hour to put them back together and so on. But anyway, the next morning or a few hours later, you'd get this gigantic printout and see if your thing worked. But again, there was that incredible aesthetic pleasure of, you know, seeing the thing click into place and working, and then also, you know, aiming for a kind of elegance in it. I mean, this is something that, you know, advanced computer science people talk about is the elegance of certain kinds of design and programming. So there is an aesthetic to it. So that was just a fun little anecdote. And I also used to stay there late at night. My boyfriend at the time was also taking the class and loved computers. And in one of the rooms, there was a row of lights on the computer that were, you know, a horizontal row of little red lights. And you could play a game that was kind of like Pong. So you would hit a button, and it would send the light flashing along these toward the other end. And then when you hit the button, the timing between the penultimate light and the last light, if you hit it as close as possible to where it would light up the last light, but not before, but not when it did, you'd send it back, going hurtling back to the other side really, really fast. So you'd get this pong game going, and you try to. It was sort of a game of chicken, because of course you hit the thing too late, you just lost. So it was like this crazy, you know, early video game before video games. So that was late night fun in college.
So many things come to mind when you say that. I tell people I was the best 770 program that ever lived. And of course, other people think that also. But God made rubber bands to go around those big decks, the punch cards. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hold them. There was a woman who was associated with Stanford years after you, who began her desires as a concert pianist, and she realized halfway along that wasn't going to work out. So she moved to a political science and economics, and that was Miss Rice, the late Secretary of State,
oh, yeah.
The provost at Stanford, who was very well known for recruiting basketball players. And my son was he knew when he was in the sixth grade that he was going to be a screenwriter. And he worked toward it, unlike me, who didn't know him.
He is now, isn't he?
Until after college, yeah. The image of Stanford was an engineering and technical university, but you wanted to be in the arts. What made you choose Stanford rather than you would see for film writing or NYU for film writing or other art schools?
Well, I wasn't really crisp about exactly that I wanted to do film. But what happened was I was under a fair amount of pressure by my family to do well in school. My parents wouldn't accept really anything less than an A. You know, like an A minus was questioned. You know what I'm saying? So I had a fair amount of pressure on me, and I had high standards too. So I worked very, very hard to get into Stanford, and when I was accepted, I wasn't expecting to be accepted because it was pretty tough at that time. Well, it's still tough, but the number of women accepted was even lower at that time, the ratio. And I wasn't expecting it, but when I got in, I was so thrilled and honored to get in that I just said, I'm going there. You know, I'm just thrilled. I mean, it's a tremendous opportunity, so I'm going to go. So at that time, it wasn't, I don't think, you know, it was prior to all of Silicon Valley and all of that. So although it was, it became very known for being a technical school, at that time it was maybe a little more broadly divided or broadly focused. For example, the psychology department at that time was one of the best in the country.
Yes.
It wasn't particularly known for the arts, but it did have decent programs. As it turned out, they weren't quite a match for me and what I wanted, but I still have no regrets going there at all. And as I said, I was just so thrilled to get in. Honestly, I was just, and I was very lucky. We weren't wealthy. But I had a wonderful situation in that, well, my dad was a Navy flyer during World War II, and he had lost his arm in a plane crash up in the Aleutian Islands while they were testing Loran up there. And after he recovered, where he met my mom, she was a Navy Corps woman, a hospital Corps woman at Mare Island, and she met him when he was recovering from losing his arm. And after that, he began to work for the VA, and he designed a program to help rehabilitate amputees like himself. And he worked for the VA for 40 years. And as a result of both his service and his VA work, I had quite a remarkable scholarship available to me, where they would pay my tuition wherever I went. As it turned out, Stanford was pretty expensive proposition for them, but I knew that I would be able to go there because I had that scholarship, and I was a national merit semifinalist as well. So I was able to go there I knew that I would be able to afford it, even though it wasn't really in our budget otherwise. So when I got the opportunity, I said, "Oh yeah,
here I am." Right? Yeah. I was. I listened to you when I was just the opposite. I was all the way through grammar school and early high school. I was number one in my class, and my father died in seventh grade. And my mother did not put pressure on me. She would have liked to, but she wasn't able to. And I. From then on, I was a rather mediocre student because I only did what I was interested in. I would read things for 5 years ahead, and I wouldn't study French or I wouldn't do things like that. And it was really only after college that I was able to get into something that I could really throw myself into. That was programming, as you mentioned, and 30 years later. My son was just like that. He could spend hours in front of the computer game, and then he'd sit down at the table to study Spanish, and can I get a glass of water? I have to go to the bathroom. I have to do this. And it would drive me crazy, and I realized I was just like that. But I was trying to put pressure on him that my mother couldn't do on me. But it worked out for him, too. In your master's thesis, you married film with high tech. Please tell us about that.
Oh yeah, that was a lucky fluke actually. After I discovered in junior year of college that I had my music major pretty much done, but I didn't want to do anything with it, and I discovered film. I took the only filmmaking class that you could as an undergrad, and then the rest of it was all grad stuff, and they wouldn't let me into it. And so I proposed to them that I become a co-terminal student, get a co-terminal degree where I would get my BA in music and my master's in film. And they said, no, we can't allow that because we don't allow any Stanford students to come into our master's program. The master's in film program was very tiny at the time. It was like 12 students. They took in 12 students each year. And I said, why? And they said, well, because we want somebody who brings something new to the table. We don't want, you know, somebody who studied film here to now go on and get their master's in film here. And I said, well, I've only taken the one course, and I'm a music major, so that's something different. They said, no, we can't let you in because you've already done, you've gone to the undergrad here. So I got kind of pissed off at this because I thought it made no sense. So I went to the registrar's office, and I asked to go through the files, and I found somebody else that they had let in who had gone to Stanford, and I brought that to their attention. They said, oh, hell, okay. All right, if you want it that bad, you can get in. So anyway, so I got in and did these classes, and they were, you know, very, very intense. And really during that time they sort of introduced the work ethic that it takes to make it in the film business. There's nobody who is kind of partially into the film business. You don't do it casually. You do it with intense passion and incredible focus. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen. So that became my life for a year as I did the master's program classes. And then you have to do a thesis. And you could do a screenplay, you could do a film, or you could write a paper. And I figured, you know, I have a pencil anytime, I can write. But I have the equipment all available to me now. I really want to do a film. So I was sort of fishing around for what to do. And meanwhile, Richard Atkinson, who later went on to run all of the UC campuses, was at that time the head of the psychology department at Stanford. And he had a really unique program of teaching children to read using a talking computer. It was very, very advanced for its time. Of course, was working with some of those same people that had worked on thing that I've studied that I did in junior high, and they had this program set up in one of the elementary schools in East Palo Alto, and he was going to give a talk, and he needed a film to accompany his talk, and he needed it like tomorrow. Well, I'm exaggerating, but he needed it really, really fast. So he came to the film department and he said, "Who do you have? Who can make a film for me really fast? It has to be. They have to get all this." So they asked me. I was so thrilled. So what happened is, I then in a month turned around this thing for him. I think actually it was less than a month. But what it was a documentary about this program, which was really quite groundbreaking, because it, first of all, it was the way it showed the benefit of computers in education in a really powerful way, and a way that hadn't been seen before. And that was that children, first of all, are immediately attracted to technology. So one of the features of this is they had these machines set up for these kids in a special room, and the computer learning took place outside of the normal classroom time. And whenever it was their time to do it, these kids would run in there, like, so excited, and they couldn't wait to sit down at these big terminals and put on these big, you know, clumsy headphones on and fire it up and start playing, really. To them, it was play. And that's, of course, the key, and it's one of the things that, you know, that is true of the stuff that, been, you know, Alan Kay has designed in later years for children to learn, is that when it's designed right, learning feels like play to kids. And so this was really fun to shoot. This was another feature about it is that there is kind of privacy, and so you can make mistakes while you're learning stuff, and nobody but you and the computer hears this. Another feature he had that was very innovative for the time was feedback. So it was designed that they would hear on the earphones this friendly human voice talking to them. And so it would say, type cat, and then they would type C-A-T. And then, but if they made a mistake, the voice would go, no, cat. And then they would try it again. And then if they did it right, it would go fantastic or great or, you know, wonderful. It would give a variety of different cues. So they would get immediate feedback, and it would be fun and funny and so forth. Plus, of course, the stuff was really beautifully designed. So it had a curriculum built in, but it also had a looped, kind of construction so that each child would be looped back through things that they were having trouble with until they mastered it, and so on. So these things were very tailored, you know, individually to the child, with pretty much no effort on the part of the instructor. So it was a very, very successful program. So I had a heck of a lot of fun shooting this, and it was the first time I sort of discovered, of course, some of the challenges of portraying technology with film, because the screen itself isn't very interesting.
But you hit some very important things there. I've always found that people that grew up with technology, they understood that unlike almost anything else in the world, that you do things to do them over. People who came to it later who are competent in other fields are the people that I find could get the most upset and annoyed if they have to write something over, or they made a mistake and they lost some document, and they go... Whereas many computer people say, well, damn it, I got to do it again, you know. So I think that was very important. The other thing was early in my career, I was one of the first people to hire women programmers on Wall Street. There were in other places. And then we had a stable of high-quality women, and there seemed to be as many in the field as there were men, particularly with IBM and with other firms. Years later, we have this whole thing about women aren't in the field, and from watching my son and my daughter, I thought that the whole shoot 'em up games that got my son into it and other boys into it tended to turn women, young girls, off at that time once we got into these games, and they didn't gravitate to it the way that they had earlier. And I know the woman to work with Alan at Apple, Ellen Hancock, has contributed very heavily to same-sex girls-only schools, thinking that that's the way to really have them focus, where they don't have these people hanging around playing shoot-up games. So these things, they're still going on. And then in the film industry, as a production assistant and then the screenwriter leading to the classic and groundbreaking, the aforementioned Tron. So many questions related to that. What was the original inspiration for the idea? Then how did you ever get into the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center to use this equipment?
That was an interesting transition. So, well, I can tell you a little bit about what happened in between, if I could.
Sure.
So I had this. I finished this documentary film for Dr. Atkinson, and then I sort of went down to L.A. with that in hand, hoping to break into the film business. But of course, that's a documentary film, and my real interest was in narrative film, you know, feature film storytelling particularly, and television at the time as well. But I had no connections. I had a couple of names, basically, from one of my professors at Stanford. And, you know, I started making the rounds, and, you know, I took a couple of sort of jobs right off the trades. I got a job as an assistant as a production assistant on a low-budget feature, and then I became a second AD on that because the person above got fired and everybody moved up a notch. And that was a really good experience. But I was trying to get in as a story person at the studios because I was most attracted at that point to writing. And I thought I wanted to be a writer/producer. So I had an opportunity at Universal, and I sent in my they had me do some sample synopses of a book and a couple of scripts and analyze them and give them my thoughts about their, you know, viability for a feature. I did that. I got that job, and I moved up quickly, and I soon became the kind of the story development person for the head of feature films there, who was Ned Tannen. The reason I bring this up is because there was another little computer thing that went on, and during this job, I was at Universal for 4 years, and I was all story involvement, and I basically covered scripts for the studio. I tried to find writers and match them to projects that they had in development. I did notes on all of the scripts that were in development and for feature films at the studios. And I also covered theater and the comedy scene for the studio. So I probably worked, you know, like 80-hour weeks as young people in the film business, especially in the studios and the agencies, tend to do. And I had a lot of fun, but it was a very, very high-pressure situation. But the computer connection there is this. At the time, they had in the story department, they were covering, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pieces of material would go through the studio. Several hundred a week, you know, would go through. And they had a number of people who were reading these things and logging their, you know, their reports and so forth. And they were... they put these in, you know, literally they were in paper files in this funky little building across the street from the Black Tower. And I suggested that they computerize these, that they put these things, that they enter the data into a searchable form so that, you know, you could pull up, you know, because right now they were relying on, you know, people with good memories to remember that, yes, we did have a really great script that took place in Maui. And, you know, yes, we did really have a great script that could be the new Sensoround script. And they couldn't put their hands on these things that they wanted to find at the time. So my suggestion was that. And my suggestion was roundly dismissed because they felt the argument was like, oh, no, then the computer will start taking away our decision process. And I'm like, no, this is a filing system that I'm proposing, not some kind of algorithm to, you know, sort this stuff by quality. It's a filing system. And they absolutely did not get that. So, you know, I was just sort of aghast at that, but I didn't really have enough influence to have any say there. But that was my first bump against the film business. Now, of course, things have completely changed since then. This is quite a while ago. But anyway, so then after I met Steven Lisberger, who was the director of Tron, while I was still at Universal, and we hit it off. We were working together on a movie called Lightning, which actually never saw the light of day. But we were trying to help the script along with that idea. And he was a young animator out of Boston who had a wonderful way to make a lightning special effect. And we were working with the man who invented Sensoround. So he was looking for the next big special effect that he could, you know, put into the movie theaters. And so I was kind of brought on board as trying to find an actual story with people in it that would that could carry this effect. And so the two of us kind of hit it off, and that was our first contacts. But at that point, I had been at Universal for 4 years, and I realized that I wasn't really an executive at heart. They call them suits. I just was not a suit. I was a creative, and I really wanted to write and produce and do other things. I didn't want to spend my time in meetings about other people's movies all the time. I wanted, and on the phone with agents and so on, I wanted to actually make movies. So I left to work with Steven Lisberger on Tron. And for a couple of years, I worked with him. And so during, it was during the research process that I went to the only computer store that existed in Los Angeles at the time. And it was a little tiny kind of a homebrew supplies place in a side street in Santa Monica. And we went in there, and there were a few books. And one of them was called Computer Lib. And I bought
sure.
that book.
And
remember
the Dream
that?
Machine. And the Dream
yeah.
Machine. Ted
yeah,
Nelson.
Exactly. You turn it upside down. There, half the book was one side, and they turn it upside down, and half the book was the other side. And that in that book, I read about a bunch of people, but particularly about Alan Kay. So in continuing the research for this movie, this idea, I should say that the idea at that point was what we wanted to do was Stephen had this glowing figure that he created for actually an ad for a radio station, and he had in his head that it would be a video game warrior, and there was a story somehow to be told inside a computer featuring this video game warrior named Tron. That's all he had at that point. And I said, well, there's got to be a person in there. And then I came up with the idea of this a real life person who's shot inside the computer. And then it becomes kind of an Alice in Wonderland or Wizard of Oz, journey once inside the computer. And so researching the computer itself, like what is actually in there? What is, because I believe in science fiction being based in reality, and I'm a fan of more of science fiction than I am of fantasy. And I felt that basing the stuff, basing what's really in there would make it infinitely more interesting. Truth is actually stranger than fiction. So anyway, we found this book. So I scheduled a trip up to the Bay Area so that we could meet several people who had been mentioned in this book. Well, Alan was the last person of the day, and Stephen and me and one other person who was sort of a consultant named Uri Geva. The three of us went up there and met Alan, and I remember that so clearly. He was still at Xerox PARC, and he and his group had just done all the seminal work that they are well known for now. And in fact, they had given the famous demo to Steve Jobs, I think, 2 weeks prior to that. And I got the same demo.
Which Adele Goldberg hated, according to the stories, and she wanted to throw Jobs out, according to all the stories about that.
Yeah. Well, she isn't a particularly vindictive person. That doesn't sound right to me. But I wasn't there, so I don't know. a lot of stories about that time have been skewed with emotion over the years. But it was a pretty exciting, thrilling time, and Alan was and still is an extremely positive person. So I remember waiting for him in the lobby of Xerox PARC, and he came out, and he was so ebullient, and he had on like polyester pants with snags in them, and like really nerdy clothes on, and a terrible haircut, and I thought he was adorable. Instantly, and I had to create a character based on him. I just had to do that. But so that's the emotional reaction, and then the intellectual one was even more profound, because the three of us sat with him for what we thought was going to be a half hour interview. It turned out to be 3 hours. And Alan, do you know Alan at all? Have you met him?
I met him briefly with you, and I spoke to him years ago, and when he was going down to Los Angeles, I wanted to write about him. And then I have a story about him that I'll get to later that he may remember. And of course, the famous and I'll paraphrase it, that we can't predict the future, but we can invent it. The line
yeah,
which is wonderful.
Yeah, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And
right.
So he just like... anyway, he started talking. We had a few questions ready for him. But he started talking, and he began to connect the idea of what a computer is, what it could be, with education and children and art and music and theater and psychology and religion and, science. And he connected this vast, sort of constellation of creative ideas, and he so inspired me. I mean, the three of us were sitting there on the couch listening to him, and I mean, our hair is like blowing back from our heads. We were just so blown away by this. It was just like, oh my God, that's what this movie has to be about. So on the plane back to LA, we were talking, and it's like, okay, there has to be a character named Alan that became the Bruce Boxleitner character eventually, and he is the creator of this Tron thing. And Alan had talked about what was then called an agent. It's now called the computer thing that represents you inside the world. I'm blanking.
An avatar.
Yes, it's now called an avatar, but at that time it was an agent. And what if Tron were some combination of a video game warrior, which is a very proactive kind of little program, but it's programmed in a kind of limited way to like win a certain kind of contest but be creative within that tiny little context. But what if you married that with an AI program that was being trained to be an agent for a really, really smart user? And so that was the initial thought about what Tron could be, and that came out of that meeting with Alan Kay. I insisted on something that Stephen hadn't at that point thought of, which is that there needs to be a parallel story in the outside, the real world, and then the inside world. And so I began to really develop those characters and what is going on the outside, what's going on the inside, and how do they connect. And so it also occurred to me that it would be really fun if, there was kind of this larger theme of hubris, and what if Tron, in taking on these AI characteristics, what if he began to wish he could be more human, and he began to question his creator Alan, how could he become more human? One of the features that differentiates an AI program from a human is, well, there's many obviously, but one of them is the sense of humor. AI programs don't generally get jokes, so I created this sort of funny sequence in which he was trying to learn, like, what is a sense of humor and so forth. But also, but similarly, there was a bit in who was a character in the movie who wanted to be more than a bit. He wanted to jump out of the bit stream and be able to say something other than yes, 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 no, no, no. He wanted to be something other than positive or negative. He wanted to have an opinion. So he too had sort of some hubris and some goals of being kind of a higher level character. So I started to get very, very excited about all these ideas. And anyway, Alan kind of set that off, and he began coming down to L.A. Every week, and we began working on the project and hit it off and became friends. And you probably know now we've been married for more than 30 years.
I know that, yes. I remember how enthralled my son Luke, the Natanj, the now screenwriter, was by Tron. My wife Barbara and I, both computer professionals, were taken by the story and the animation, but our enjoyment was really magnified by his captivation by it. But I remember discussing the film with some computer scientists out of IBM's Thomas J. Watson Research Center, which was very close to me, and they were equally taken. They should have been really proud of the response to the film.
Well, I had personally had a mixed response to the film, but I think a lot of writers do when things get changed. But I was really, really thrilled by the visuals on that film, the music, and I thought that Jeff Bridges was a phenomenal actor, and I thought he in numerous drafts which followed mine, a lot of the humor went away, and all of the science, so much so that Alan actually took his name off the film. But Jeff Bridges ad-libbed a fair amount of humor back into it, and ultimately, I think it was a really exciting film that opened up the idea of computers to a lot of kids, and I've I teach screenwriting at UCLA Extension, and I've had many, many people in my class tell me that for them it was some kind of seminal film, and that it really meant a lot to them as kids.
Did you have anything to do with the subsequent Trons, with Tron 2 and the plan for Tron 3?
No, nothing.
Okay. But you didn't get pigeonholed in it's only science fiction or animation over the rest of your career. You wrote more screenplays, moved into television, feature development, where you won the local Emmys, into documentaries, where you won national Emmys, been into the ownership of your own production company for 11 years, developing both television features and material for corporate clients. Tell us about those activities. How do you move from place to place?
I get bored easily, so I do tend to like to get new challenges and try new things. And after Tron, I worked as a screenwriter for a number of years, and I sold a whole lot of scripts to Hollywood. None of them were made, and that sounds terrible, but if you know the business at all, actually that's success as a screenwriter. It's just not very satisfying because you don't get to see the thing, you know, go to production. So I became frustrated by the business in that sense, and I thought, you know, I really want to actually take something to completion. And I returned to my roots in documentary making, and because I was taking an acting class, and there I met a man who was doing short feature segments for CBS. And I thought, you know, I've never really worked in video before, and I do documentaries, but I've never worked in this short form. I think it'd be fun to try to do these short form video docs for television. So he and I formed a partnership and started doing those for CBS, and we immediately won the LA area Emmys for feature segments in 2 years running doing those. And so we realized we had a kind of a good creative combination between us, and so we formed a company. Because of my tech background and interest, it just happened that our first clients were all tech. And so Prodigy and Radius, IBM and Apple and others. And what our niche became documentaries about how technology changed people's lives. How it changes people's lives. And so they were kind of people stories, and we traveled all over the country doing these for these various companies. So that was kind of fun. Meantime, I kept writing, you know, entertainment scripts and selling them and so forth. We actually never won a national Emmy. I wish we had, but we won several regional awards. And later on, we actually, as a team, this guy named Jim Shasky and I, as a team, we did a film for Alan on his program called Squeak, which was a program. It was a program and a curriculum for children to learn higher-level mathematical thinking and beginning programming by basically constructing toys electronically. And similar to the thing that I described long before this, you know, at Stanford, children, when the thing is designed right, children can end up programming and doing very, very powerful things, and they feel like they're just playing. So in this particular case, in the Squeak documentary, we showed, elementary school children doing differential equations and not realizing that that's what they were doing. So that was quite fun. But these things, from a film standpoint, are pretty challenging because you've got lots of pitfalls inherent in doing a documentary about computers. You know, a lot of the interesting stuff is internal or mathematical, and you have to find ways to visually represent that. But also you have to capture the enjoyment and the thrill of learning that for these children. So that was a quite fun thing we did, actually. And we had this company for about 10 years. And that was the story of that.
It's interesting you mention how technology affects people. That's been the I'm on my 171st column on the theme of creative disruption, and the whole theme of it is how technology changes everything around us, and we don't realize it till either the person next door lost his job, or there are no music stores in the mall anymore, or some of the bookstores they're going out of business, and it's all this happening around us, and if it doesn't personally affect us, we very often dismiss it. It was through your production company that I first met you. Bill Atkinson had created the development tool HyperCard for the Macintosh and become wildly successful among Apple users.
I loved that program.
I was the contributing editor to the magazine HyperAge and had written about the roots of hypermedia back to Vannevar Bush and the aforementioned Ted Nelson. I was also teaching the HyperCard course at New York's New School. So I was asked to chair the panel that Macworld needed in 1988 or 89 on HyperCard and the innovation ways it was being used. You were the first presenter on the panel. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Although the main Macworld conference was in the Ordinary Conference Center, our presentation and a few others were in the Wang Auditorium, a 400 or 500-seat hall with great acoustics and twin 25-foot screens to project to the audience. We packed the theater, and although I thought we were wonderful, I was quite surprised by the size of the audience. Surprised, that is, until your husband, Alan Kay, came out from behind the curtain at the end of our presentation. He and another fairly well-known attraction, Bill Gates, had been on the panel before us. They built the audience, and we were lucky enough to hold it. Well, maybe it was raining out. Do you remember if it was?
No, but I do remember that I followed Bill Gates
yeah.
in this presentation. I do remember that quite well.
So yeah, quick, Alan.
That's pretty funny.
A quick Alan story. In the early 1980s, the conference board had a conference, the New York's World Trade Center, for company presidents, and the idea was that these people didn't really understand technology that well, but they signed the check. So the idea was that we would take them through technology and spreadsheets and communications. And the night before the conference, we had this dinner, and we were told, don't over-tech anything. Make sure that everything is just common sense. And so Barbara and I were going to discuss spreadsheets and run workshops. The next morning, I happened to be having breakfast with the president of National Gypsum, who had flown in from, I believe, Cleveland. And he was saying, I don't know why that I'm here. I really don't understand this. I'm going to be wasting 2 days. And I said, no. We were told to just explain things in a common sense business way. Well, the opening keynote was a guy from IBM who had taken Don Estridge's place. And he was just plain awful. It was a dark room. They were showing you slides, and they were using terms like a system design network architect technology. And they were showing slides of all this terrible IBM application software. They were only mentioning things from IBM, and it was awful. And all the people there, the only thing that they knew was 123 from Lotus, and didn't even mention it. Then I was sure they were going to be running to the airports. Alan was with Atari at the time. And he gave a wonderful lunch keynote, things shown on the walls and gestures, as did Bob Lucky from Bell Labs. They saved the conference.
Yeah, Alan, I know Bob, yeah.
Alan may not remember that, but it was terrific. And there is no more World Trade Center there, obviously. Well, enough of Alan. You also studied acting at two prestigious Shakespeare schools. You do acting in production at the L.A. Area, and you teach writing at UCLA's Writers Extension Program. Tell us about those activities.
Sure. So after running this production company, doing a lot of tech-related stuff and also continuing to write, I got tired of that at a certain point. And my partner, Jim Chasky, sort of retired from that as well. He took on teaching full-time, went to Ball State, where he was a very successful film teacher there, film and TV production teacher. And I decided that I would sort of drop a long undropped shoe and do some acting. I had wanted to act all my career and all my life. And I thought, you know what? Hey, I'm the age I was, which I won't say, but getting on. And I thought, if not now, when? So I thought, what the heck? And then I said, well, what is it that I really need to know that I don't know? And I have never covered Shakespeare in my entire educational life. And weird as this may sound, I got all the way through 2 degrees at Stanford. And all I ever had at school was 2 weeks of Julius Caesar, which is outrageous when you think about it. I attended Stanford right at the point where they trashed all of the dead white authors and decided that, you know, these were not so relevant. And so Western Civ kind of just went in the garbage can and was replaced by many other things, some of which I think are wonderful and others were, you know, shouldn't have taken precedence. But in any case, I was without Shakespeare at this age. I thought, this is a gap I have to fill. So I jumped in and I started attending plays and reading and studying. And then I went to the British American Drama Academy, which is an intensive Shakespeare performance workshop held at Oxford every summer. And then I did another intensive at Shakespeare and Company, which is the premier American Shakespeare training place. And it's fantastic. It's in Lenox, Massachusetts. And I started acting in Shakespeare in Los Angeles, and then I also was doing some musicals. I did Redigore. I had a lead role in Redigore, which is Gilbert and Sullivan, and a bunch of other plays, mostly classical plays, but some comedies as well. And I just was having the time of my life, so I did that for 10 years. And then I decided I had an idea to teach writing. But since, remember I told you way back when, the thing that got me into film was discovering that it was the art form that encompassed all the art forms. And so I decided that teaching writing had to be done in a way, teaching screenwriting particularly, had to be done in a way that used the other art forms that are involved in filmmaking, because a screenplay is the blueprint for a film. And so I basically, because I had studied intensely, I'd studied music, I'd studied acting, and I didn't mention this, but all throughout all of these years, my hobby was watercolor painting, and so every holiday I had was spent pretty much at an art workshop. So I was pretty advanced as a visual artist by this time as well. So I decided to employ the things I'd learned as an actor, as a musician, and as an artist in the service of teaching screenwriting. So I created this kind of unique class, which was called Screenwriting on the Right Side of the Brain, WRITE. And it was partly inspired by Betty Edwards, who wrote Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, RIGHD, a seminal book about proving that one can learn to draw, that drawing is a meta skill, and that when it's broken down into smaller skills, each one is learnable, and anyone literally can learn to draw and draw beautifully. And I know Betty, and I've taken her class, and know her quite well, and it's proven, and she's an amazing woman. So I wanted to try to find out what those exact modules were for screenwriting. What were the smaller skills inherent in that meta skill that I could actually teach people and guarantee a result? And I did find a number of them, and I've had a very good class. And anyway, it's been very successful and a lot of fun.
And now, drum roll. To your lifelong passion and current activity, you mentioned in your note to me that you fell in love with Sherlock Holmes when introduced to the stories at age 10. Tell us about this long-term affair that culminates in your forthcoming novel, Art in the Blood.
Sure. Well, Art in the Blood is my novel that's coming out this fall. It's going to be released in England on September 10th and in the U.S. on October 6th. Art in the Blood is a Sherlockian term because Conan Doyle used that phrase in The Greek Interpreter. That's one of the short stories in which Sherlock Holmes says, art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms. And he's referring to the artistic temperament, and he's referring to himself because he is supposed to be his grandmother was the sister of the very real French artist Vernet. So I got very interested in Holmes's artistic temperament. I first fell in love with Sherlock Holmes at age 10 when I was given a copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and I read it cover to cover, and then all of the adventures, which were included in other books as well. I just sort of inhaled them and was just fascinated by this character. I guess you probably can infer from all the stuff that I've said that I am very attracted to smart people. And so
I
like stories about smart people. I like intelligent heroes. I'm not really interested in stories about losers so much. I'm interested in really, really smart people who are highly challenged and somehow meet the challenge. And they can have, you know, flaws, or they should have flaws. It's more interesting. But I love a smart character. And so Sherlock Holmes was just an early love, and it's never gone away.
Otto Penzler, the previous guest on this show, owner of New York City's Mysterious Bookshop and the editor of The Big Book of Sherlock Holmes Stories, wrote after reading Art in the Blood, in a world with more than a share of Sherlock Holmes, of the pasties, it is rare for one to soar above the rest. But Bonnie McBird's Art in the Blood achieved the singular feat and deserves a tip of the deerstalker. That's high praise from the person who's been in the business of evaluating books for a very long time.
I was thrilled when he said that about Art in the Blood, and it means a great deal to me. Otto's a highly respected man in the world of fiction overall, but especially in the world of mystery fiction, because he's been both an author, an editor, and a publisher himself, and he runs the oldest mystery bookshop in existence, called the Mysterious Bookshop down in Soho, and he's actually special editions of certain books that he chooses, and he does a canonical number, canon referring to the Arthur Conan Doyle canon of 54 short stories and 56 short stories and 4 novellas of Sherlock Holmes. He does 60 copies of special editions, and in that edition of Art in the Blood, he will be including original illustrations I did in the style of Sidney Paget, as well as a set of annotations which are inspired by my friend Les Klinger, who is one of the foremost Sherlockian experts in the world, who did the annotated edition of Sherlock Holmes that's very, very popular now.
I can understand your interest in it, but the interest in Holmes certainly didn't dive with Conan Doyle, and in recent years the interest seems to once again be at a high point. To what do you attribute this 100-year interest? Many things have gone away that were considered important writings in that time.
I think Sherlock Holmes has been a really incredibly enduring character for 130 years for a bunch of reasons. The main ones to me are the fact he's never really gone away. There have been big waves of interest throughout this 130-year period, which I could name, but they usually coincide with some kind of mass media, either a movie or a clip, the William Gillette play, you know, through the various movies throughout the years, TV shows and et cetera. But I think the real key to the enduring popularity is that, first of all, it's the character of Sherlock Holmes himself, the brilliant but flawed man who actually is, you know, crusading for justice and doing so in a very unique way, but one that we think is a possible way. He's a superhero who doesn't have superpowers other than he's really, really smart. We feel really, really smart when we read him and we spend time with him. You know, we feel smart in his presence. Those books have in them probably the greatest friendship in the history of fiction. The friendship of Watson. Everybody wants to have a Watson, and everybody would love to be a Watson to somebody else. So there's those. I think particularly right now, the appeal of Sherlock Holmes is that he's so rational, and rationality in these stories triumphs. And that's not the way our world is going. Our world is chaotic and dark and scary and inexplicable. And yet, if we travel to 221B in this gaslit world of fog, and we still have horror and crimes, and yet they're controllable and they're fixable, and this man can solve the problem. And it's a very, very comforting thing, which is, you know, kind of why we like mysteries anyway, is that, you know, like a good computer program, like clockwork, things click into place in the way that they don't in real life. And, of course, that's really the function of art, too, is to make order out of chaos. And these, I think, are just incredibly satisfying. Also, Conan Doyle is just a genius writer. And so in my, you know, effort to emulate him, I learned so much as a writer. I mean, the pacing, the tone, the humor. He's a very funny writer, which people may not realize it unless they read them closely, is that he's quite funny, and he has the pacing of a modern-day storyteller, even though he's a 19th-century man. So for many, many reasons, these things are perennial favorites, and I think they will be in the future as well.
When you mentioned the superhero without superpowers and the close friend, you made me think of Batman and Robin.
There have been many, many things kind of modeled on Holmes and Watson over the years, too. I mean, you think of House, you know, the show.
Yes,
House.
Yes.
Definitely.
And the address, House, the address is the Holmes address.
Yes.
When you mentioned Conan Doyle, one of my interesting characters, what I understand of them, and as much to keep working on, is Pierre Théon de Chardin. And as you probably know, he was the young paleontologist who was taken in by the Piltdown man that Conan Doyle was involved in with his partner, and his partner supposedly was the one that planted the fraudulent bones. Have you read much about that?
No, I haven't. I've heard of it, but Conan Doyle was quite involved with much of the science and also the spiritualism of his day. He had a far-reaching set of interests, and he involved himself in a lot of different things.
What do you think of the works that such as the 7% solution that focus on his drug taking, or the whole series about Irene Adler that make her his wife and his partner? Do you have good feelings about works like that, or are you negative on them?
Oh, well, first of all, I can't generalize, but I have to say the 7% solution is one of my all-time favorite Sherlockian pastiches, and I think I think Nicholas Meyer did an amazing bit of storytelling there. Of course, Sherlock Holmes's affair with cocaine is well known. I mean, it is in the original books. Of course, cocaine was not quite the dastardly thing that it is now. I mean, it was quite common. You didn't need a prescription and so forth. And they also did not fully understand the addictive and destructive qualities of the drug. But that being said, I mean, Watson was concerned about Holmes's use, and he did seem to have a bit of a problem with it. So that's original to the series, to Conan Doyle. And again, I love Nicholas Meyer's 7% solution, because although, you know, it took that to an extreme and took him to a very damaged state, it was in the service of, you know, getting him mixed in with Freud, which is just a tremendously fascinating notion and beautifully executed. In terms of the other versions, I mean, there's so many different variations on Holmes, and that's certainly true now. And people choose different aspects of this character and his life and times to go off on, basically, in their own riff. And I would never really criticize another artist's work in this sense. I like some of them better than I like others of them. I particularly, for example, enjoy BBC Sherlock, the modern update with those particular actors and that particular writing, with some quibble on the last episode, but overall I quite like that show, for example. But each new creator who takes on Sherlock Holmes has to make a set of choices about what they will emulate and try to recreate and what they will be creative with. And so, you know, those are artistic choices. And you know, you either enjoy the ride or you don't. So for me, I tried to write the kind of book that I want to read, which is I like to stay close to the originals. I set it in the same time period. In fact, I went over the canonical timeline, particularly the one that's organized by Les Klinger, because this is disputed among Sherlockians. And anyway, I found a time that nothing had happened, and I slotted my story into that little window. And I also wanted them to be quite young, so they're in their 30s in my story. And I wanted to do nothing that would contradict the canon. But that being said, I still took some liberties, and people will either like or not like those. For me, one of them was when you expand a Sherlock Holmes story to a novel length, it requires some different structural and thematic work than is present in the original Conan Doyle. Conan Doyle wrote short stories, and the longest he wrote was novellas of around 40,000 words. But you think of a novel as between, you know, mystery novel, adventure novel is between 65, 85, and up 1,000 words. So when you have a longer form piece of dramatic writing, a couple things happen. One is that you kind of need more, if you think of it as a suspension bridge and you have towers that appear every so often, the longer the suspension bridge, the more towers you need to keep the structure up. So these sort of, from a dramatic writing standpoint, these towers are kind of what we call set pieces in screenwriting, so big action moments. So there may be more action in mind than there would be in a single Conan Doyle short story, but yet maybe cumulatively it doesn't feel really different in that sense. Also, a longer form will require a little more thematic content, and typically in genre fiction, adventure, and mystery, you don't have a strong theme. I wanted to touch on the theme of what does it mean to have an artistic temperament? And then what gifts does that give you? But conversely, what vulnerabilities does that give you? So that's kind of like a little background theme in there. Anyway, so again, any of us that write Sherlockian works or emulate in some way, still, you know, we pick our own lines in the sand and, you know, just hope that, my hope is that Art in the Blood is enjoyable and will give people a great fun ride.
I particularly like John Gardner's Moriarty books that were, I guess that must be 30 years ago, 25 years ago. I find short story writing to be the most difficult. I've published poetry and I write a nonfiction for years about technology and a novella, but in short stories you have to develop the character so rapidly, and I find that the most difficult. What's next for you? Will it be more Holmes novels?
Well, HarperCollins bought Art in the Blood from me, and they contracted me to do a second novel, which I'm working on now, second Sherlock Holmes. It's called Unquiet Spirits. It has to do with ghosts and the whiskey business. And they have an option for a third. So hopefully I'll be writing Holmes for a while. I love living in that world, so I'm very happy about that.
That's terrific. We have a caller on the line from the 802 area. A caller, are you there?
Yes.
Do you have a question for Bonnie, or do you have a comment?
I do have a question for Bonnie. I would like to know if she started the screenplay yet for Art in the Blood.
No, I haven't. I haven't. I've been thinking about it, though. Right now I'm pretty much focused on getting the second book done. But I have been thinking about it because I do have a director in England who is interested, somebody with some fairly big Sherlockian credits and who's become a friend and is quite interested. So I may be moving in that direction.
Oh, wonderful.
Koala, are you a Holmes aficionado or familiar?
Yes, I'm a Sherlockian.
Okay. Are you familiar with Bonnie's other work, with Tron, or with any of her teaching or anything?
I'm very familiar with Tron. That was one of the movies that I really enjoyed. And that was a real groundbreaker.
Okay, well, do you have any other questions before we let you go?
Who does she see playing Sherlock Holmes in Art in the Blood?
Oh, that's a good question. When I did the paintings, the Sidney Paget style, I used the same technique as he did, which is he hired his friends to pose in the scenes from his story, from the Conan Doyle stories. And so I hired two actor friends of mine who are in my head exactly, look exactly right. So one of the, Rob Arbogast here in Los Angeles played Sherlock Holmes, and Paul Denniston played Watson, and Robert Mamana played the French rival detective Vidocq, who is claiming to be a relative of the real Vidocq, but is not. And the three of them were kind of in my heads as the actors. But in terms of movie stars, I really haven't thought about that. And I these three actually are such phenomenal actors that I would actually love to do the movie with the three of them.
Sounds brilliant.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Bonnie, we've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
I think that's pretty much it. I can't think of anything else, John, and I really appreciate your having me on and asking me all these questions. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Art of the Blood is available. You can pre-order it. It's not out yet, but you can pre-order it on Amazon and all the other electronic sellers as well.
Remember that, audience. The personal note before we wrap up, yesterday, July 25th, would have been my father, John W. McMullen's 111th birthday. Unfortunately, he, the New York City police officer, like his father, died at the age of 46 of a head injury. While much of our life together has faded into forgotten memory, the image of a bright, funny, and loving father stays with me, though I often wish we had more time together. And for commercial note, as I mentioned earlier, my writing is, my column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmacrants.com. Send any comments or questions to me about the show or any of my writing to johnmac13@gmail.com. And now, in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmac13.com, for previous shows, and tune in next week for my conversation with attorney Edward Fitzgerald. And, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Be well, everybody, and thanks again, Bonnie. And my engineer is not bringing up the closing theme, but it is about to come. Here we go, steady, big fella, steady.
Good night, everybody.